Hello and welcome to Willosophy with Will Anderson. I am Will Anderson from the title of the podcast, and I'm going to be quick because I have to catch a plane to Alaska in a couple of hours. I've been flying around a lot recently. Thank you to everyone who came out and saw me on the Dollop Tour live. We did three nights, Seattle on Friday nights, Saturday night we did Portland, and Sunday night we did San Francisco. The first of those is already up. You can listen to it. Just download the Dollop, search the Dollop. If you've never heard of the Dollop, it's an alternative American history podcast. Last week they were number one on US iTunes. So it's a brilliant podcast, really funny, but also really informative. So if that sounds like the thing that you might be interested in, and maybe you like me because you've come to this podcast, one of the first ones to dive in would be the most recent one. So download that and have a listen to the Dollop. So there's the first plug. There's heaps, by the way. If you hate the plugs, if you're not into the plugs, fast forward a little bit because I've got a few. So I'm off to Alaska. If you know anyone in Alaska, if you're in Alaska, Fairbanks, Alaska, for the next 4 days, 5 days, Wednesday through Saturday, doing shows in Alaska. Then the next week, Wednesday or Thursday through Sunday, I will be in Denver. And the week after, Thursday through Saturday, I will be in Madison, Wisconsin. After that, in the first week of January, I'm in Bermuda, that's where it is, right? Where the triangle is. I know nothing about Bermuda, but I'm going there to do some shows. So if you're in Bermuda and you listen to the podcast, or if you're going on a holiday to Bermuda, or you just get lost in the Bermuda Triangle and you find your way down there, I will be going to Bermuda. Then after that, January 22, I'm recording my special for Stan in Australia. It's called Fire at Will, but it's really a combination of the best bits of my last two shows, Free Will and Fire at Will. So I'll be recording that at the Comedy Theatre in Melbourne, January 22. If you want to see that live, there are tickets available to that. They are almost sold out, so you'd want to get in quick. My brand new shows, there you go, here it is. February 20, I'm doing a week of trial shows, work in progress shows in Canberra. They're nearly sold out, so get in quick if you want to come to those. And then Critically Will, which is my brand new show. It's going to be the biggest tour I have ever done. Very excited about it. Got some big ambitious plans for this year for what we're going to do with the show, doing my biggest ever Melbourne Comedy Festival. Okay, so I'll run you through what's going on. Basically, it starts in Adelaide Fringe, doing 2 weeks there. Then it goes to Brisbane. I'm moving up a venue. I normally play the Powerhouse, which is a beautiful venue in Brisbane, but we're going up a little bit in size this year. So I think it's at the Town Hall. But anyway, the details will be out soon. It's not quite on sale yet, but that's coming up after that. Then after that, I'm going to Hobart. I think Hobart might already be on sale, or it's about to be on sale. Going to Hobart for one night only to do the show there. I've got a month of shows in Melbourne at the Melbourne International Comedy Festival at the Comedy Theatre, my favourite home of comedy. I've, you know, done six or so, maybe even more shows there at the Comedy Theatre, and I love it there. So I'll be doing a whole month at the Comedy Theatre, but also in the final weekend doing a couple of big shows at the Arts Centre. Now, the Arts Centre is the first place I ever saw stand-up comedy when my mum took me to see Billy Connolly when I was 17. So it is very exciting that I'll be doing a couple of big shows there. So if you want to come and see something special, maybe come out to those shows. But I'll be doing the whole month in Melbourne. And also, speaking of good venues, April 8th, I think it is, but it's basically the second weekend of the Melbourne Comedy Festival. I'm not doing a show on the Saturday night because I'll be doing my show in Sydney at the Sydney Opera House. Now, you know it's exciting for me to do the main hall there at the concert hall there at the Sydney Opera House. And we recorded my special there, Willuminati, on a Monday night, I think. And last year I did Fire at Will there on a Thursday night, I think. Now, here's the thing. You get one night at the Opera House and you're trying to sell out two shows. And we've done pretty well, to be honest. It's been pretty exciting. But obviously, what you want is a Friday or a Saturday night. That's what you want to do. You want to go out to the Opera House on a Saturday night. So that's what's going to be happening. It's very exciting. So I will be doing my brand new show, Critically Will, at the Sydney Opera House. One night only, but two shows on the Saturday night. So there you go. That'll be fun. Come out to that. After that, there will be shows in Perth. And I'm looking at Darwin as well. And I'm hoping there'll be some other places as the tour goes on. I'm putting a lot of work into this one. And I'm hoping that I might spend a lot of next year, you know, just touring around the world doing the show. So come out and see it. I think it's going to be really fun, and it's what I'm going to be working really hard on. In the meantime, I am also going to try to be doing some of these podcasts. If you're only a listener to this one, Willosophy, and I look at the numbers, there are some of you who are. I have some other podcasts. They're more regular than this. There's one called Tofop, which comes out every week with my friend Charlie Clawson. It's pretty immature a lot of the time, but we've been doing that for 6 years. That's the original podcast I did, and Charlie and I do that pretty much weekly. There's another one called Fofop, where I do it with like international comedians. So maybe if you're interested in kind of bridging the gap, here's what I would recommend. If you're more into the philosophy than the stupid comedy ones, there's a couple of episodes of Fofop that you might enjoy. I did two of them most recently with a guy called Graham Elwood, the director of Earbuds, the podcast documentary, but also from Comedy Film Nerds. And another guy called Dave Anthony. Now, Dave Anthony, if you don't know him, he does a lot of my episodes of Fofop. We've probably done 70 plus, 80 plus episodes together. And so we chat a lot. And he and Graham, in two separate episodes, have a lot of interesting thoughts on the US election. So maybe if you want to hear some from some Americans about what happened, they might be interesting episodes for you. Okay, so that's the plugs. I have a footy podcast also with Charlie. It's called Two Guys, One Cup, an AFL podcast. So if you like AFL football, you might want to look that up and have a listen. But anyway, here, look, I'm going to have a sip. I'm going to have a sip of my kombucha tea, and then I'm going to get into telling you what this episode is actually about. So, Mark Colvin, I was very excited to do this. Mark Colvin is an Australian journalist, for people who don't know, a broadcaster. He's been the presenter of a ABC radio program, which is considered far and away the most prestigious. Well, AM and PM, there are two flagship ABC radio programs that are kind of considered the height of journalism in Australia. And to be honest, when it comes to radio journalism, by a fair distance in a lot of cases. So, and consistently on a day-to-day basis, you can tune into these programs and hear an in-depth analysis of what is going on in the world in a way that you can actually still trust. Now, the truth is that I don't dip into it as much as I should. And I'm the sort of person who, you know, is up to that sort of thing. So I guess for some people, it's not a program they listen to, but it is a program that I think the world would be much richer if everybody took the time to listen to. I was very excited to have him on the show. This podcast, okay, how do I explain this best? So I'll do a recommendation. There is a radio program in Australia on the ABC also called Conversations, hosted by the brilliant Richard Feidler, who I hope to have on this show at some stage. Richard and I have talked about it. We just haven't been in the same city to do it yet. And he has this excellent radio show that they also release on iTunes in podcast form. And I do make the differentiation because it's not a podcast. It wasn't made to be a podcast, but it is a radio program that, unlike some other radio programs, which is just really the best bits of their radio programs that they release as a podcast. And I don't really consider that a podcast. You know, in the same way as like if you put a TV show, like if they put Seinfeld on YouTube, it's not suddenly a web series, you know. It was made to be a television show. You can rebroadcast it in that way. And it's a small differentiation, but I think it's one that I certainly make myself, you know, not necessarily with great judgment, but I think that there is a differentiation. But it is an excellent program, and it is well-researched and well put together. And they did a two-part episode with Mark because Mark has just released a book, and the book is about, you know, his life and a particular part of his life. And I didn't really want this podcast to be about what's in the book because, you know, then you won't go and read the book. Like, you know, it's more interesting to me to read the book or to know what's going on in someone's life and then maybe ask about some other things that aren't covered, you know, in those things. And then hopefully, you know, you might be interested enough in those things that you go away and you can fill in the gaps yourself. All that other stuff's already out there. You don't need me to go over it. I listened to Richard's excellent conversations, the two-part conversations with Mark Colvin, and it was wonderfully autobiographical. It did a great job of being an accompaniment to the book itself, you know, bringing alive, you know, passages that are in the book. But I think it would be something that would be excellently listened to in conjunction with reading the book. And I think you would enjoy that. This, I hope, is something different to that. You know, I hope that we just had a chat, you know, that Mark and I had a chat. The thing I will say is that I was nervous, and I don't necessarily ordinarily get nervous about this, but Mark and I don't know each other well. We know each other a little from the internet and just bumping into each other, but But we don't know each other well. And you know, I am genuinely respectful and intimidated by him. I find him a wonderfully intelligent and fascinating and, you know, sort of, you know, a person I really genuinely could have talked to for hours and days and, you know, had the conversation go on weekly, to be honest. And I think I would find him endlessly fascinating and you know, and intimidating. And I certainly I haven't edited this podcast at all. I considered editing a couple of things. And the first one is because we did this a couple of days before the US election. And so there's some stuff in there that since what happened. Actually, to be honest, I think there's some stuff in there and some stuff that we talked about off air that actually probably it turned out to be true, which was that both Mark and I, and we had a more extended conversation about this off air, but there's a little in the podcast about the idea that if it was close enough, we did fear that Trump would win because we felt like there was some Trump voters who weren't telling anyone they were Trump voters. And it seems that at least in a small part, that was part of what did indeed happen. So I did think about editing around that. And there's another part where Mark does what anyone does in life, where he flips around. We're talking about North and South Korea, and he flips around the capitals of the two. But and then he corrects himself. So I'm like, well, why would I edit that out? Like, you know, I mean, we all, the smartest people in the world, you know, make these sort of mistakes. And then I thought for a second about editing for my vanity, which is something that I never do on this podcast. Like, I have been always very conscious of, like, I will edit something out if somebody who is a guest of mine, they're going to look terrible if I leave it in, or if they ask me to take it out. Like, but my own stuff, I try to leave it in, warts and all. But in this one, my questions are terrible. They're terrible. And I think the intent of my questions is good. That's what I will say. Like, the things that I'm trying to ask Mark are things that I genuinely want to know about. But I think what part of the problem was that I couldn't put into words what I was genuinely trying to ask him, because I found him so interesting that I was always trying to ask him a question and a half. Or really what I just really wanted to say was, just tell me everything. Just tell me about everything. Tell me everything that I don't know. Just fix stuff for me. Reassure me. Just be smart and tell me how I can be smarter. And, you know, and so that's really was just the intent of all my fumbling long questions. But if you've sat through this introduction, you are used to me doing things that are fumbly and long. So thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thank you for everyone for supporting this podcast, even how irregular it is. I've never checked numbers. I'm just not a number checker. And also, I don't want to make the differentiation between episodes. I like to imagine that I just put the episodes out and equal amounts of people at least listen to each of them. Even though, you know, in my head, I know how the world works and I know more people are going to listen to the Tim Minchin one than listen to, you know, one by somebody that they perhaps have never heard of before. But I, the service I used to load the podcast, I was loading it up the other day, and what they've done is they've added a feature where you don't have to go into the place to check what the numbers are. Just when you're loading up the thing, the numbers are just of each episode, that how many downloads it has. It's just there. And so what I realized was I hadn't checked it in years, because I barely have time to fucking do the podcast. I certainly don't have time to sit around like checking the numbers or whatever, you know. But I was very pleasantly surprised to see how many people had been listening, not only to, say, the Tim Minchin episode, although that was certainly a very large amount of listeners, and I was a little overwhelmed when I saw that, but also, you know, to some of the ones that maybe the names I would consider to be less well-known. I must admit, a little surprised to see how many people had been listening to those. So thank you very much for that. I appreciate it. I have another podcast. Did I mention that? I've been doing it for years. Some of you fuckers don't listen to that one. I've rambled way too long. But I did give you a warning at the start that this was going to go on. So if you're one of those smart people who skipped and you've just tuned back in going, surely he's over by now. I'm not. But I am now. Enjoy this episode. Hello Hello and welcome to Willosophy. I'm Will Anderson from the name of the podcast. The podcast that just won't die. It feels like a horror movie, this one, because I keep wanting to put it down, to be honest. I've sent this podcast to the farm a few times in the last year in my mind, and then here's what happens. I remember that I asked somebody months ago to do the podcast, and it's finally time that they have a book out, and I think, oh, well, it'd be nice to do the podcast now. You know, this is a good time probably for both of us to do the podcast, so now I'm doing another podcast. This may be the last one, or I may have promised someone else something at some stage. So anyway, it's brilliant. I'm so glad to be here, and this podcast always starts with one simple question. Guest, who are you?
My name is Mark Colvin. I am half English, half Australian journalist and broadcaster, and I think probably my identity is pretty wrapped up with the last part because I've been doing it for 42 years.
I mean, people already know that just from the way that you speak compared to the fact that that was my introduction. You must be staring at me like, what is going on?
not at all, because Mr. Anderson, I used to listen to you and Adam on while driving my son to school every morning.
That's interesting to me, even that moment, because you have a connection. You were at Double J, right?
Yep.
So, I mean,
founding member. Well,
absolutely.
For a couple of weeks after it started, I joined.
So this is what's interesting to me already is, because there is that sort of idea of like that, it, you know, if you were there as a founding member, the time that Double J was actually really good was the day before that. Like, that's the attitude of people who would listen to Triple J.
Yeah, yeah.
It was always the best just before you got there, right?
No, so really not. It was because actually when it started, it was kind of it really was totally revolutionary. Because before that had been this commercial wasteland,
Teenage
wasteland of commercial radio stations that would only play singles. And most of them were beeped out, you know, if it wasn't. John Lennon didn't sing Christ, You Know It Ain't Easy. As far as Sydney was concerned, he sang Beep, You Know It Ain't Easy, because 2SM was owned by the Catholic Church. So it was high rotation, top 40, and that was all. And yet there was this huge group of people who were going out to independent record shops and trying to get their and reading imported magazines like Rolling Stone. There was no Rolling Stone edition here, then, and New Musical Express, and buying albums, but they had very little in terms of what they could choose from. They didn't know what there was out there, and suddenly Double J was there, and it really wasn't. There wasn't a golden age pre Double J, because those first few years became the golden age. I mean, we had,
and I mean, I think that's absolutely right. So. And I guess that's kind of my point is like some things need the times to be perfect for that to happen.
Yeah.
I barrack for a football team called the Western Bulldogs.
You do, and well done. Because I barrack for the Swans, and I hold no grudge because I was there in 2005 when we won after 60-something years, and it was an amazing feeling. And
yes, I performed at the Swans breakfast in the morning of the 2005 grand final. The Sydney Swans are my second team, but it was... And it was an amazing moment. And somebody asked me, what do you think about next year? How will they go next year? And I said, to be honest, I don't care. Because the moment that happened, I'm never going to be able to wait that many years again for this same thing.
That's right.
Part of how great it was how long and long-suffering it had been beforehand.
Yeah.
That was all now part of that story to this great moment that I can enjoy. And I can never enjoy it again in the same way.
The sport is kind of like theatre without the just hold on.
It's okay.
Please.
No, we can get out. That's fine. No, that's okay. You sure? Look at you. You must be important. That's what I like. They decided they'd change their meeting. Saw who was in here.
I think it's probably you, actually.
Between the two of us. I guess the question.
We were talking about the. I was just saying, sports like theatre without the predictable ending. Hamlet always dies at the end, you know. But you don't know how it's going to turn out, and that was the one performance of Hamlet where he didn't die, wasn't it?
Right. Yeah. It's the one that you've been going for every time. Yeah. It's like somebody who's been going to watch Hamlet like 1,000 nights in a row, just hoping. They've heard that there is actually one night where he doesn't die, and I am not going to miss that night.
Yeah.
I don't care where I am in the world. Yeah. I want to see that.
Yeah.
So to be part of something in that moment, some of that is beyond your control. I was lucky enough that at age 42, I'm at a stage in my life and career where I'd followed the team for long enough and been through enough of the heartbreak to truly enjoy the story, but not be at an age where I was one of those people who's like, now I can die. Like, you know, I still can enjoy it a bit. And I was able to be included in it a bit because I was lucky that it was at the right time in my life. So Double J, what did it feel like to be part of something that was genuinely sort of, you know, countercultural?
It was incredible because this is hard for people to remember now, but because there was no internet, because communication was so slow, Australia wasn't just a few weeks behind the rest of the world. In a sense, it was still about 5 years behind the rest of the world. So Double J felt like, you know, the summer of love or something, you know, but happening half a decade later. What brought you there, though?
How did you become part of that? What drew you at that age? How old were you?
I was 21 in seven. No, I was 20. I was 22. Okay. I was 22 in seven at the beginning of 75 when I joined Double J. I was 22. I'd just finished my cadetship at the ABC. Traineeship of a year, and that's why I wasn't there on the first day, because the cadetship ran out 2 or 3 weeks after the station opened, and they wouldn't let me go until I'd finished. But I was really champing at the bit, you know. And I had this, you know, I'd grown up, a lot of my childhood, I'd grown up in England, and the BBC had a station called Radio 1, which was pretty mainstream. But it had a guy called John Peel, who's probably one of the most influential kind of youth broadcasters, rock broadcasters, has ever been. And before the BBC started Radio 1, there'd been a couple of pirate radio stations called Radio Caroline and Radio London. And you used to push to, let's have our holidays in Suffolk, because it was closer to the little ship in the North Sea where Radio Caroline broadcast from. They were literally pirate stations. Right. They broadcast, well, there's been a couple of films about them, of course. And so there was, Peel was on one of those. A guy called Kenny Everett was on one of those. And he was an absolute radio genius. He was a great friend of the Beatles, actually, and he used to produce the Beatles' Christmas records. And he had the same sort of sense of humour and the same influences of the things like the Goon Show and so forth. But he was just a mixing genius. This was all analogue in those days. Stuff that sounds easy now was really difficult then. But Kenny pioneered, you know, backwards tape recorders and speeding things up and slowing things down, and the man was an absolute machine for producing new characters. He had a television show in
right.
the end
so
as well,
this
yeah.
is where I, the so, part of this story that I'm familiar with is growing up watching the Kenny Everett video show on the ABC.
Yeah,
and I remember many of those things are imprinted in my mind. You know, Kremen of the Starfleet and, like, you know, Sid Snot and bits like that.
Yeah.
In fact, there is a famous, because I was telling a friend of mine about this one Sid Snot routine that I remember, because Sid Snot's big joke was that he'd be trying to toss cigarettes into his mouth, but he could never get the cigarettes in his mouth. But I said to my friend, I said, I remember when I was young, he definitely in one of the sketches catches the cigarette in the mouth.
Yeah.
And then this is the world we live in now.
Yeah.
You can actually go to the internet and find it on YouTube. And it's there is a famous one. G'day, Sid Snot here. The other day I was in the park, throw cigarette, misses. Feeding the pigeons, throw cigarette, misses. To my cat, throw cigarette, catches it. It's pretty much goes down like that. It's a very funny joke. I heard you talk about this.
So it was kind of intersection of comedy, rock and roll, the counterculture, you know, whatever you wanted to call that. And I'd grown up in England, mostly in different places. But the writer Kingsley Amis said it was a period when you could walk into any pub in a provincial in England and say, has the major been in? And they'd know who you were talking about. The place was populated by ex-wing commanders and majors and lieutenant commanders from the Navy, whatever, you know, chaps with leather patches on their elbows who smoked pipes and told you that your hair was too short, too long.
Okay.
Get a haircut.
Sure. very much the, you know, the opposite, the thing that was being rebelled against.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. That was the dominant culture. That was what the counterculture meant, I think.
Right, which is, again, an interesting point in of itself, which is the need for a culture to be one specific way. There is a, I don't know if it's absolutely true, but in comedy there is a bit of a theory that, you know, comedians flourish, particularly political comedians flourish during more conservative periods than they do during more progressive periods, because there's just more to rail against or whatever.
Yeah, well,
it is.
Alexis Sale and Ben Elton and all those people came up largely because of Thatcher, didn't they, really?
Absolutely, yeah. And there has been parallels about that around the world, and I understand, you know, I would like to think that, you know, if you're doing your job properly, that you can find equally sort of, you know, interesting or hypocritical or, you know, whatever things to talk about on both sides. But anyway, regardless of that, I do think the idea of having something to battle against or put yourself up against the wall of can create something amazing as well. So you're at Double J. What is your role there at the time? What are you doing at Double J?
There's about three of us to produce all the news for the station. So we started off producing news bulletins, and then at that age, in that atmosphere, fairly fervid atmosphere, that last year of the Whitlam government, there was so much else to do, and we were all interested in lots of other stuff. So we started creating, you know, an environment round and an arts round. And we started a thing called the Prisons Program. I think that's the first time anybody in the world had ever done that. That was Nick Franklin who really started that, using letters from prisoners and interviews with ex-prisoners. The New South Wales, it was only a New South Wales station in those days, and the New South Wales prison system was utterly scandalous. So we were trying to break the boundaries, I suppose, but above all, we were just trying to kind of process the news in a way that people would understand who were 18, or, you know, it wasn't all about what was going on the stock exchange or anything like that, but B, to actually talk to those people, to find out what they were interested in and talk to them about the things that, again, just like the music that hadn't been played, there were lots of subjects that hadn't been talked about, particularly, for instance, sexual health or the state of schools and the autocracy of schools, or, you know, there were an awful lot of things that were kind of challenging the establishment again.
And how much backlash was there to, you know, I mean, you know, if you are suddenly putting all those things out there, what was the reaction? You know, what sort of, you're still part of the ABC? You know, like, so there's still, you know, I mean, I know when I worked there in the early 2000s, you know, the amount of pressure that comes with being part of the ABC, even though you're the, you know, the kids' arm of the ABC.
Yeah, yeah.
You're left to some of your own devices, but not all of your own devices. There are certain things that you still have to abide by. So what was that like back then?
Well, it was the there was pressure from outside and pressure from inside. So there were the Bishop of Maitland, for some reason, which is in the Hunter Valley, who theoretically shouldn't have been able to get the station at all, because it was, we had this weak little transmitter, but he somehow managed to get himself.
Probably put an antenna on top of the church.
Probably, yeah.
He told everyone who's being building a big, look, we need a bigger cross.
Spire.
Yeah, out the back, listening to Skyhooks.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, so Skyhooks was what caused the first backlash, because it was the first You Just Like Me Because I'm Good in Bed, banned everywhere, first record played. Fred Nile, who was the leader of the Festival of Light, and this is 40-something years ago, yeah. And he is still a member of the Legislative Council in New South Wales. He was very prominent in condemning us, but also the Deputy General Manager of the ABC, a guy called Clem Semler, was infuriated by the whole thing, said it was absolutely disgraceful, and that we were, in light of what I was saying to you before about the music that the commercials wouldn't play, he came out with this bizarre argument that we played music that was only suitable for commercial radio. So there was a whole generation that just didn't get it on all kinds of levels. And not only the music, he was disgusted with, there was a documentary series we did called The Ins and Outs of Love, which was all about sex, one way or another, and getting young people to talk frankly about sex, which was just astonishing at the time, really, really brand new. You think it's stuff that you would just put on ordinary local radio or Radio National now, frank talk, but it wasn't about people it wasn't about the strength of the language. It was just the idea that you would talk about this at all. And in a period when you were supposed to get this from your priest or your teacher or your parents, and instead you were getting it from your contemporaries.
I mean, there must have been a part of that that was really exciting as well, though.
It was fantastic, I mean, yeah.
You know, that opportunity, that there were so many things that, you know, were out of bounds. Were you, I mean, what was exciting you at that time? Was it journalism? Was it just being part of this kind of, you know, new thing in Australia? Was it your friendship group? Was it all of these things? What was kind of the, you know, at that age in your life, what were you predominantly, you know, concentrating on?
It was a bit of all of that. It was amazing sort of social scene, Double J.
Yeah. I can imagine.
Yeah, it was just fun.
I can only imagine. I've heard some stories.
Yeah, well, Friday afternoons were always great. There was always a party at the end of the week, and you're just living in this atmosphere where the music is just rocking out all over the building every day, and there's new stuff being played. And as time went on, the first year, 75, the great thing about the first year was that you had everything going back to about 1965 to get through, you know. Right. So you could go back to Joni Mitchell and early Dylan, and people just hadn't heard some of the albums and some of the tracks and so forth. And then 76 comes along, and suddenly it's new wave, punk, all of that. Everything's changing all the time, and there's sort of battles going on in the station. People want more reggae. People want, you know, and there's actually a big battle inside the station about punk. You know, there are people who want real music and all of that sort of, it's roiling, and the whole station is run kind of like a collective. So all this gets played out in these weekly meetings where people are lying around on sofas or lying on the floor or getting up and shouting at each other about everything from the music.
I was lucky enough that I was in the last era of the weekly meetings at Triple J, well beyond the point where it was, you know, play your own music or anything like that. You know, by the time we were there, I think, you know, we could probably get away with a song of our own an hour or something like that. But we did get much more choice than that. We made a few editorial decisions. Occasionally we wouldn't play a track that we just didn't like that was in the schedule. But it was still the era of the weekly music meetings.
Yeah.
And I love those meetings.
Yeah.
And I think there was a diversity of ideas in those meetings, and that's what always made it great to me.
Yeah.
Is that I think that, and this is not a necessarily, because I don't know enough about what's going on there now to make any criticisms at all. And so this is not me making, but I like the idea that what those meetings used to produce was, you know, the metal guy come in and he'd have five tracks, and four of them were unlistenable and would never be played other than on the metal show.
And then somebody was carrying the flag for hip hop, and somebody was et cetera, et cetera.
And all you would need is that one moment or that thing, having that expert who would come from all these different areas, and even having someone in the room who wasn't an expert. You know, I never considered myself to be a musical expert. I was like a comedian who loved music. But what I would do was meet a lot of our fans. You know, I'd go to the Big Day Out or I'd go to music festivals or whatever, and I'd meet a lot of our fans, and I would understand what they liked. So I always thought
You were also in there arguing for Guns N' Roses all the time.
Bit of Guns N' Roses, I've got to be honest with you, and a little bit against Motorace. So I'm so sorry if any of the members of Motorace are listening to the podcast. I feel in retrospect I was a little harder on you than I needed to be. But anyway... okay, so we haven't actually got to the thing that I meant to ask at the start, but that's okay. I don't mind. So
this is fun.
Yeah, right? This is good. Okay, before we get to the philosophy then, I want to just take one more beat off the road. You talked about, fast forward, you talked about listening to Adam and I on Triple J.
Yeah.
With your son?
With my youngest mostly.
Okay, sure. So that to me is interesting. Did you keep an interest in the station, or had you come back to the station through him? Who got who interested in it?
I came back. We came back from London at the end of 1997, and there'd been nothing really quite like Triple J there, and we just had it on in the car all the time, actually, from early 1998 onwards, really, for the next few years.
I mean, that's amazing to me, because I know what some of that stuff must have been like because I just know how few skills and how many anxieties I had at the time about, you know, being this kid from the country who'd done a couple of years of stand-up and then I was suddenly living in Sydney, yeah. You know, this overwhelming city, hosting this show with this, like, insanely, you know, smart and, you know, confident, you know, guy that I'd met, you know, on Good News Week. I'd met him on the telly.
Oh, right, okay.
You know, he had a radio show, you know, yeah. Like, I was certainly always felt like I was the person who at some stage somebody was going to come and tap on the shoulder and say, hey, there's been a mistake. Sorry. There's been a horrible mistake. And what I think that meant that I did, you know, in retrospect, if I had my time over, you know, is that I probably tried a little harder than I needed to. Like, you know, I feel like
yeah,
I was...
Look, the good thing about it for me was that it was a continuation of that idea that at Double J, that not that it was an amateur radio station, but that it didn't have to sound super professional. And if you go back, I mean, somebody was saying this to me the other day, listening back to the few tapes that still exist of that early period, and then you listen to what the ABC sounded like at the time and what the commercials sounded like at the time. Well, the commercials were that, you know, hyper-professional, shouty, lots of echo chamber on the microphone and full of Revive 45, Stacks of Wax kind of slogans. And the ABC was much more sedate and every word was written and it didn't sound... I mean, most of what I do on the radio is written, but I write it to be as conversational as possible and I'll go off script when I need to. But Double J sounded like people your age talking to you, and it didn't sound like people were desperate to grab your attention. They were going to get your attention just by being themselves.
It's interesting to me. You seem to have an open mindedness to it. And I think that a lot of people do. Like, but the generational thing has been.
By the way, it helped that you were really funny.
Well, I feel like if tapes existed, I might be able to prove you wrong. I may have been occasional.
You weren't funny every day,
yeah, the bits you remember. Yeah, that's what I always say to people. People come up and go, you guys were great. And I'm going, I'm so glad that tapes of it do not exist so you can go back and have your memories destroyed like I did when I tried to watch The Goodies in my 40s. The thing that I am interested in is this idea of checking into the next generation with open-mindedness.
Oh, yeah.
So, or with an open mind, I guess is the best way to put that, is that, you know, I felt like that when you got involved in Twitter as well. I feel like you've been a person who doesn't, you see so much in the press and stuff, oh, Twitter's stupid. It's, you know, this new media's stupid, everyone's stupid. Yeah. And it's like Triple J is stupid now. They're all stupid. This idea that you go into these things with some sort of open mind, is that something?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's kind of part of my DNA is open-mindedness. Also, I've got so much out of Twitter. I've got so much out of people who are much younger than me, people that I've met through Twitter, people, my own sons, you know, my music. I was fairly closed off to Radiohead until my eldest son persuaded me and now I'm an absolute Radiohead nut, you know, and lots of music that I've got since. They say that your musical taste gets stuck either when you're 27, you know, 17 or 25 or whatever, but I've never really liked that idea. I like lots of the music that was playing on Double J at the time, but I'm always open. I love it when I find a new band.
Yeah, I love that as an attitude, and I hope that I am that person. But of course, as you get older, you increasingly find that you go back to the things that you like and you know more regularly than you go to something new.
Yeah, it's like a bit of elastic in a sense. But the other thing that I've, because I'm really a lyrics person as much as a music person, and these kind of great writers keep coming along.
Yeah, absolutely. So, okay. I meant to ask you, do you have a philosophy? That is actually the question that I meant to ask you at the start of the podcast, and we're 25 minutes in.
Okay.
So, I haven't quite got to it early on, but I feel like this has been okay so far. So, do you have one?
Yeah, I think you could probably describe me as a stoic. I'm an, in terms of religion, I'm an agnostic. I think there's a one of the things that happens to you is in terms of having a philosophy, is that you probably have a character which decides some of your philosophy, but you may not know what that is. You may go through your whole life not really knowing what that is, but if you have a near-death experience, then you find out quite quickly who you are. And back in 1994, 1995, I was 6 months in hospital, but more to the point, I came very, very close to death. I had a disease which meant that I was hemorrhaging badly from the lungs and the stomach, and to such a degree that they ran out of my blood group in London and had to chop some more down from Manchester.
Wow.
It was that, you know, I was losing blood that fast internally. And also my kidneys failed and my lungs filled up with fluid, so that if I even leaned back a few degrees, I would start to drown in my own fluid.
Uh-huh.
And that was a period of about a month. Not quite as bad as that all the time. That was the worst of it. But it was a month before I was out of the woods, and even then I was really, really sick for a long, long time. And what I learned from that was, when you're younger, I think most of us have periods of despair or darkness where you think, you know, do I want to go on? I don't mean that I was suicidal, but, you know, can I really manage this? Do I really want life that much? And what that taught me, because I really never even considered dying during that period, what that taught me was that I've got some kind of inner resilience, that I am somebody who wants to live. So that's the innate part. And then the learned part, I think, is, and this is where the stoicism comes in. You know, you think stoicism is just resistance to pain or a stiff upper lip. It's not that. It's actually a proper philosophy, which is about understanding that the universe is not in your control, and that the only things you should ever worry about are the things that you can control, and that's mostly things within yourself.
Yeah, I think that is certainly something that I recognize a lot of in my life. In fact, it's because I've chosen a very creative and often very random life.
Yeah.
It is that nature of the fact that I treat it, and I think without having studied it,
yeah,
and certainly my father hadn't studied it. He's a dairy farmer born on the road that he now lives on 73 years later. But I would say that is almost how you would best describe him. And I feel like it's the best quality I took from him, is just try not to worry about too much about the things you cannot control.
Yeah.
But also to have a kind of constant, you know, and again, I know that's not exactly what you're talking about, but I do like that idea of...
That's part of it.
Where did that come from?
That all goes back to...
I know that you say that some of it is, like, you know, innate. It's your character. It's who you are. But how do you feel like that had developed as being your predominant characteristic?
Well, you think it through because of what you have to go through.
Right.
And there's been an awful lot of things that have been out of my control. And so chronic illness, particularly that first 6 months, I always joke that the word patient is very carefully chosen, because what you need is patience. But it's also understanding that if you're going to survive these things, you have to sort of do what you're told. You've got to trust the doctor. You've got to respect the doctors. And I've been through the hands of a lot of very, very experienced specialist doctors, obviously renal physicians and rheumatologists and all of those people. I really despise anti-vaccination people and alternative medicine people and I still get it, you know, you should really try. I've got an immune system disease, which means my system goes crazy. The immune system goes crazy. And it's remarkable how many people tell me that I need such and such a herb or drug or alternative medicine, whatever, because it will boost my immune system. I don't need it to boost it. That's the problem. You know?
Actually, they need a little bit of your immune system.
Yeah.
In like 1/10 of that in a jug of water, and we'll start our own little business on the side,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to me that because it feels like that is rising, that anti-vaccination world, that distrust of science world. I feel like it's why we're not paying enough attention to climate change in the ways that we are, because they are issues where you just have to say, I trust science. I give over my ego to the fact that there is someone more qualified than me to make this decision.
But you don't just do it on trust. You don't have to just do it on trust. You can then, it's like evolution. You can, people say evolution is a theory. Well, yes, it is a theory because science works on theories. You can go and look at that theory, and then there's a philosopher called Karl Popper, the great philosopher, 20th century philosopher of science. And basically what he talks about is something called falsifiability. So you take a theory and you try to falsify it. You keep on attacking it, wave after wave of attacks. And gradually what happens, evolution is a great example of that, is that you keep on attacking it and the probability that it is correct grows and grows and grows, and the probability that it's incorrect reduces and reduces and reduces. And no scientist will ever tell you, this is one of the problems with the climate change debate, no scientist will ever tell you that the probability has reduced to zero, because they're scientists, and what they will tell you at most is that the probability of X is approaching zero. You know, that's the point, that you can, if you're interested in evolution, or if you're interested in vaccination, or if you're interested in climate change, you can trust them, or you can go and really immerse yourself in what they do and say. There are great writers about all these things, Stephen Jay Gould on evolution, all kinds of people, you know. And so, yeah, I don't think it's about trust.
What they really need is the advertisers involved, because if they will tell you it kills 99.9% of germs, so they won't tell you that the point one is the one you actually have to worry about.
Right. That's right.
Whereas the climate scientists are the opposite. No, yeah. I mean, well, this is the thing with science. There's a great History of the Universe show. They do it at the observatory, the Griffith Park Observatory in Los Angeles, and they do a big presentation. They project the universe, explain where we are, and kind of it's a walk through people's theories throughout the ages of what it all meant, and you develop it. And one of the most stark reminders is that there were people who were celebrated as geniuses of their time, who's thinking, for 1,000 years, went as going, no, we've challenged it all these times. Yep. We keep trying to disprove it, and we can't disprove it. And then 1,000 years later, somebody finally does disprove it.
Yeah, as late as the 18th century, not long, I think, before Captain Cook arrived here, everybody was sure that the stuff we breathe was called phlogiston. They had no idea that it was made up of oxygen and nitrogen and the rest of it. And phlogiston was 100% believed by the whole lot of them.
So why do you think there has been this rise of the anti-intellectualism, or this kind of distrust of, you know, what these groups that we were trustful of?
I think it's really closely connected to the stuff that I do every day in terms of covering politics. I think the biggest danger that we face at the moment is that it's becoming easier. And we thought that the internet was going to bring everyone together, but instead what's happening is it's becoming easier and easier and easier to lock yourself in your own bubble and to just keep on feeding yourself stuff that is reinforcing your beliefs. And it worries me a lot, because in recent months, Facebook, which is one of the most powerful entities on earth now, has been changing its algorithm. It changes its algorithm all the time, as we all know, but it's been changing its algorithm more and more to do exactly that. If you've been interested in such and such, you will get more and more stuff about such and such. And I think that company, for instance, needs to really rethink its social responsibility.
It is interesting, isn't it, that I remember when I grew up in the country, there was a very small place, you know, 416 people, 2011 census, 2016 census, anywhere between 3 and 4 billion people. Who knows? I don't think they'll be very reliable results. But it's a small town, probably less than 500 people. And so you are constantly, when you go to anything, you have to see a whole bunch of people who are just different to you.
Yeah.
And in this day and age, you don't really need to as much. You can find, you know, at least online and in those communities that agree with the same thing. It doesn't matter what you're into, but I think it can be very positive in a lot of ways.
Absolutely. One of the, just going back to Double J, Triple J, one of the really great heartening things when Triple J went national was that in towns like yours, suddenly there were kids who were gay or, you know, had different ideas, and suddenly they had a link into community, much larger communities, and they were able to realize that there were people like them out there.
Yeah, and I think that has been a major positive.
Yeah,
of those,
it's a huge positive.
And what we didn't kind of see coming was this idea that it would also become echo chambers, that everybody, I mean, I myself, we were having a little chat about this before we started, but I myself have to constantly remind me to check in with people that I don't agree with.
Yeah.
Because it becomes very easy. Like, I mean, certainly if I had had to predict off my Twitter feed whether Brexit was going to happen, yeah, I would have called that one the wrong way.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, absolutely.
So I didn't understand what was going on there.
To be fair to you, all the polls were wrong about that. Well, everyone was wrong about that.
But tell me how you prevent yourself, you know, as a reporter, as a journalist, as a broadcaster who needs to be outside that echo chamber and consider all these things. How do you keep yourself from not being part of that, you know, not becoming part of that?
The usual arsenal of skepticism and asking the questions that journalists always ask. Plus, on Twitter, I follow about 2,500 different people or institutions, and I try to make sure that I don't confine my following to people who I agree with. By the way, that's, you know, this goes back to what's your philosophy. I don't have a political philosophy as such. I really do try to make up my mind on all the issues. I think that's really important, particularly in a job like mine. You know, I've got nothing against the idea that journalists should be on one side or another in some fields, but not at the ABC. I think people pay their taxes to trust that an ABC journalist will go at any... I'd like to think that I would go into any interview and people wouldn't know what my position was before I started. I like to think that I go for the... above all, go for the devil's advocate position in every interview, you know.
There's a difference also, though, isn't there, between achieving the truth in journalism,
yeah,
or having an appearance of, like, balance.
Yeah.
And no, climate change is a very good example of that, right?
There's such a thing as false balance, right. Absolutely.
And so...
You can't...
How do you can't, cut
you
that
can't,
out?
You can't balance the flat Earth theory.
Sure. But how do you decide which one's flat Earth and which one's
vaccination either? Mm-hmm. It's too dangerous.
Right.
And climate change is, I think, has swung way into that camp as well. Obviously, you've got to keep, and again, it goes back to the thing about science. You've got to keep testing every theory, and I don't think that you should just lock out people who don't believe in climate change. But I think largely you should lock out people who are fighting against vaccination, because the public health implications are so huge. Herd immunity is really measurable, and whatever the percentage in the 90% area it is, if it drops below a certain amount, then all the people who have vaccinated their children and protected their children by doing so are endangered by the tiny minority who don't. And so you just... It's false balance to keep on giving them a platform.
It's taking a shit in the water supply because you only drink Coke.
That's right? Very good. Yes, exactly. Oh, God.
So,
nice
things you're probably not allowed to say on PM. Right? So, I am interested in, the idea of society and how you view our role as individuals and as being part of a society. Because as a reporter, as a journalist, you have found your home at the ABC, which says to me, at least from the people that I know who work at the ABC, because you don't come here for the money and you don't come here for the easy hours and you don't come here for the invites, the Logies and those sort of things.
Yep.
You come here, I think, probably because you think it's the best place that you could fully realize what you want from your job. And secondly, you believe perhaps in some element of human beings as a society and that you have some role to fill as part of a broader society. Can you tell me how you feel about your what you think your responsibilities are as an individual versus part of a society?
Yeah, I think it was Margaret Thatcher who said there's no such thing as society. And then she goes on to say there are only individuals and their families. And it was never quite as harsh a statement as it's sometimes reported as being. But nevertheless, the effect of Thatcherism, which I covered as a journalist, as a foreign correspondent, was to smash up society to a large degree. Britain at that time was a real mess, and massive reform was needed. I have no question about that. But there was a heartlessness, a coldness about that, which I think comes from believing that there's no such thing as society. And we've just been talking about the way that people can lock themselves away from each other and from real debate now. I mean, it's very worrying that people will quite often start debates with abuse now, in ways that never used to happen, except at 11 o'clock at night just before closing time in the pub. But yeah, I think the society exists, and that people, something like the ABC, which was semi-modelled on the BBC, can be a really unifying factor in society, and it can only do that by being trustworthy.
So that feels to me like that is a reasonable responsibility to have on your shoulders. That's what I would say it is. I mean, I know that you host one of, you know, the flagship, you know, programs that people go to for, you know, reliable news. You know, yeah. Somebody's interested in knowing what the story really is and going to hear stories that you're probably not even going to see on, you know, necessarily ABC news bulletins and things like this. This is really sometimes, you know, getting to stuff that you never imagined was something you needed to be hearing about.
Yeah.
That feels to me like a great responsibility. So how has that changed in the time that you've done it? Has it changed in the time that you've done it? Or do you, with your stoicism, is it just I come in each day and I do it and I try to do it the best I do it every day?
No, well, I think what happens is you bring, you know, the great artist James McNeill Whistler. He's the guy when Oscar Wilde said, "I wish I'd said that."
Right.
He said, "You will, Oscar. You will." He was a very funny man, he was. There was a libel case, and the lawyer said to him, "How long? This picture only took you half an hour to paint, didn't it?" And he said, "No, it took me my whole life." You know. So there's that thing of there's a kind of accretion of experience, and the things that you've seen, the other people's libel cases that you've seen, the complaints that you've had to deal with from the ABC, within the ABC, from outside the ABC, but then you have to grind through the ABC's complaints procedure, that instills in you this idea that you've got to get it right. And, you know, every journalist starts off trying to get it right, but you learn more and more and more about the value of fact-checking, and also the, you know, just little tiny things. You can take a word out or put a word into a sentence and change everything. You can and change everything to the degree that you get a libel suit. And even then, I mean, one of the things that I always remember is a libel suit that Andrew Ollie, the late Andrew Ollie, was involved in, and the ABC lost because of a bizarre coincidence where he was doing a story about a particular company which was owned by a bloke whose name I now can't remember, and he was sued over it, and they'd done really extensive fact checking, and then it turned out that there was a company with an identical, it was a Sydney company, there was a company with an identical name in Western Australia, which had a director with the identical name. So you learn from that. I worked at Four Corners for 5 years too, and where you really just have to just keep on cutting away and cutting away until you're sure of a fact, because it's going to be whatever happens, it goes to air on Four Corners, somebody's going to raise it in Parliament or whatever. But one way or another, you get to be cautious, but also the other thing that I learned at Four Corners, we had a really great lawyer. We had a really great legal department at that time, and what they taught us was that you could really push a story much harder than the ABC had ever done before if you just couched it right, put it in the right context. As I say, added a word here, changed a sentence there, whatever. So the danger is being overcautious, and I try really hard not to be. Sometimes, it just happened the other day, a particular reporter brought me a story and said, you might want to just, I don't know if I've gone too far. And I actually pushed it up a bit. I jazzed it up, pushed it harder, because you just get that judgment. It's just about time and experience.
And trusting your instincts, the fact that you have done all this work up to this point to get you ready for this.
Yeah. Is that instinct? It's not. I mean, I think instinct is well, yeah, maybe that's the definition of instinct,
trusting your training to
real
the point
instinct
is that it becomes instinct.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe that's
yeah.
I bring this up a little on the podcast, but I always think of Steve. I interviewed Steve Waugh, and he was one of my favourite cricketers.
Oh,
and,
God.
I asked him what it was like. I said, how do you decide which shot to play? This is all I really wanted to know. I was like, when the West Indies are bowling to you at 95 miles an hour, how do you have the time to go, I'm going to cut it or I'm going to hook it? And he says, well, you don't really. It's not like you have that moment in your head where you say, I'm going to play the cut shot.
Yeah.
You hope that everything that you've done up until that point has put you in the position that if you get out of your own way.
Yeah.
And trust, I think he said,
muscle memory.
Muscle memory and your decision making and the fact that you've
like
done this.
Bradman hitting the ball at the water tank hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times, isn't it? You know, that's the same story.
Or the idea of, I mean, you know, Malcolm Gladwell is a bit of a pop psychologist.
10,000
hours. The 10,000 hours is... It's something that comes to mind. Look, I don't want to take up all your time because you actually have a job to do as well.
I'm having a ball.
But
mate,
I have a lot more to ask. So I'm going to keep asking away. How do you feel about the state of news and journalism now? Because you've just talked about, you've relied on, we've got to get it right and we've got to push it and we've got to make sure, that old school idea of news as being, news had to be something that someone else did not want you to know about, didn't want you to be saying, proper news, not just reporting a press release or not just saying what, this person who wants to plug their tour or whatever, their book even want you to say, you're a journalist.
Yep.
But so much of the media now is about first rather than fact, it's about being the first person to put the rumor out there or the sources say or the... So how do you feel about the state of journalism at the moment?
Really worried. I gave the Andrew Olley lecture in 2012 and I said then that the number of PRs was about to exceed the number of journalists in the country. It's long, long past that now. We are outnumbered. And it's not just that, but the newsrooms are shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. And as they shrink, people have to do more with less. That includes us. We've got much shrunken staff. And that does mean some days that stories that we'd like to get done don't get done because they just involve too much work and there aren't enough people to do them. But, we're in a relatively luxurious position. I think there are great people out there still trying to push at the boundaries, still trying to break stories and all of that. And some of them are half my age. And I'm really in favour of pushing out the boundaries of what journalism is. I mean, people think that BuzzFeed, for instance, is all cat videos and listicles, but actually they've got remarkably good journalists working there in Canberra, for instance, and they're moving out into investigative and explanatory journalism, and I think that's great because it just goes right back to that double J idea of trying to get to younger people in ways that with stories and with ideas that they might not otherwise see. But
I
overall,
mean, I think BuzzFeed, and I'm glad that you said that because actually there was a here at the ABC, and a few years ago, there was quite prominently some comments, that were disparaging of organisations like BuzzFeed.
Yeah.
And having seen what they did, particularly during the election campaign, because I was overseas for the whole time, but I was following a lot of it online. And really, some days, they were the only people asking interesting questions, or at least getting an interesting story out of the
campaign.
Mark
DiStefano and Alice Workman, they're really, really very, very good and sharp, and they've got no... They've got no idea of when to stop, which is, I think, I say in my book, I say somewhere that we were subversive at Double J, but then I think that all of journalism should be subversive. It should, you know, you should be the person at the back of the press conference going, yeah, but why or what? You know, how come on, tell us the truth. That's subversive in itself, you know, but there's fewer and fewer. That's one of the problems, actually, is that because there are so few journalists, real journalists around, you'll get to a press conference, find there's only two or three people there, where there used to be 20 or 30. And if there are 20 or 30 people, they've all got lots of different questions. If there's two or three people, they've probably just come down to get a sound grab for a news bulletin or whatever, and they might just ask one question and piss off.
I was being told a story yesterday about my co-executive producer on Gruen, a guy called Nick Murray. He loves a little bit of a protest, and there was a protest down near his place the other day, and there was one cameraman down there. And so he just, because he's curious and is a TV producer, wandered over and said, "Who are you here shooting for?" And he said, "Well, I'm shooting for everyone now. I do all the overnight stuff. They just send out one camera and everybody gets the same... You know, is getting the same footage." So you're living in a world where even competing news sources are all sourcing their footage from the one guy with that one camera as well. Yeah. So
you can flip it, though. Lee Sales, my friend and colleague Lee Sales, she occasionally will just turn up at a press conference, and because there are so few people there, and because she's Lee, and, you know, the people just hang back a little, she can just turn a press conference with somebody who's refused to come into the studio, she can turn it into a one-on-one interview.
Yeah, 7:30 unplugged. Yeah, we've just brought this in. Right. Sorry, we're taking it on the road. You thought this was a press conference? This is a surprise 7:30. Yeah. It's a new ABC show. Surprise 7:30. You don't know when it's going to happen, but you don't want it to happen to you.
Sam Dastyari.
I nearly got a gig because of Sam Dastyari, because he was going to launch Mark's book.
Oh, yeah.
And Mark did message me during that day going, "Are you in Sydney tonight?" Sam's had to pull out, it turns out. I would have thought that he probably could have done it. But anyway, so what's the hope for journalism then? If you have I've stopped buying the newspaper and I feel bad about it. I still subscribe to a whole bunch of online media sources, but it happened about a week ago. It's very recent to me. I've been buying since I was at journalism school even growing up. Even my dairy farmer dad read the newspaper every day, front to back. So it was always one of those things where I was like, well, you read the newspaper every day. Yeah. And then I got to journalism school and, you know, you would all try to outdo each other because I was in Canberra. And so everybody would try to get to class having read more, you know, national papers than other people. So often, you know, in the morning you were reading five or six newspapers before you would get to class and stuff. And then I was in the gallery and it had that same sort of, you know, the competition in that Canberra Press Gallery, even at the bottom rung, which is where I was in that, you know, this competition between you and the other person on the bottom rung, you know, to be doing more than them. And so for the rest of my life, even when I haven't had to, I have always been a person who loved buying the newspaper, loved sitting with the newspaper. And I just was buying them and I would flip the pages, but there was nothing in there that I hadn't read earlier that morning, you know, online or the night before when somebody had tweeted about it or particularly international stories. I was like, I read this in the New York Times 4 days ago online. Like, I don't know why I'm buying this anymore. So where do you see the future of journalism being? Do you see a way out of where we are now? Could it be an opportunity that we're burning it down and it's actually going to spring up, you know, like the phoenix into something better?
Well, I've said for several years that I thought that the print editions would die, certainly in weekday print editions. I subscribe to quite a number of newspapers, but I read everything on a tablet or a phone or a laptop, and I very seldom pick up a newspaper nowadays, and I don't feel that I'm missing out because of that. As you say, it's 8 to 12 hours old by the time you've got it, and what I need to be professionally is right on the front edge and the rolling edge, and I think Twitter's been fantastic for that. You know, there's been a number of nights on air with huge stories where you can just get way ahead of everybody because Twitter is just pushing it out there. I discovered that as far back as 2009. But Twitter, what you can get off Twitter is either putting together your own story out of working out who's reliable and who isn't in little bite-sized chunks, or you get really good information because you click on a link to The Economist or The Washington Post or The London Daily Telegraph or The Le Monde or, you know, all of that stuff. And so that is mainstream, the reviled mainstream media. And what do you do if that's gone? And I think there are a few good signs, like Jeff Bezos buying the Washington Post, and so far he's the guy who owns Amazon, and so far he's largely left it alone.
There was a good article in the New York Times the other day, I don't know if you read it, positing the theory that we're looking at Twitter in the wrong way, that looking at Twitter as a tech startup, you know, yeah, like it's going to be Facebook, utility. Instagram, where it's like it should be the new, like, media. And yeah. There was even an argument that he could buy it, much like he bought the Washington Post, but as
there's even a rumor going around that Elon Musk, the Tesla guy, will buy it.
Because Twitter is very interesting. I'd love to talk to you a little bit about Twitter, like not just how it is used for your work, but how you've seen Twitter change in the time that you've been there.
Yeah.
Because I think Twitter is a very different place, or it feels like a different place now to what it was when you first got involved in Twitter. How do you feel about Twitter now?
Well, you know, the experience hasn't changed that much for me. Mm-hmm. I know it's changed a lot for some people, and I think it's much, much worse for women than it is for men. I don't get, you know, horrible. I don't get a lot of really. I do get some, but I don't get a lot of really, really horrible trolling abuse. And I block seldom. When people start being really abusive, I block. But I think the introduction of the mute function has been really good, because you can just ignore people and they don't know that you've muted them.
No, I like the mute, because I think it's everybody's right to like have their own opinion on thing. You don't need to agree with what I'm saying, and you certainly have the right, in the same way as I like to throw things at the telly and get angry at people and whatever.
Yeah.
I would never want to deny you that. But I don't need to hear about it.
No, exactly.
That's for you. That's not for me.
Yeah, yeah. And so sometimes I'll just mute somebody for a day because they're just really boring. They're carrying on about one particular fixed idea.
Please, anyone who's listening to this, if it's a day where I have to sell a lot of tickets or something, feel free to put the mute on. Just flick it back a couple of days later. It's fine.
Yeah, no, it's more you. The boredom I'm referring to is more that somebody will just say the same thing again and again and again, express the same opinion. But I think the other thing is, I think just there's something about the way that I do Twitter myself, it actually reads, or sometimes almost reads, more like an old style news feed coming off a telex. You know, it's just links to stories with a droll headline or a straight headline, whatever. And also, I've always been extremely, tried to be anyway, occasional. I occasionally lose my temper a little bit, but generally I try to be extremely polite in responding to people. And so I think people pick up on that a bit. So I have very good conversations with people, and I think I get quite a bit less abuse than some people do in our area.
I mean, I certainly think that, as you mentioned earlier, women, particularly online.
And it's
I think
horrible. That's it's the one where I see dreadful. It.
And of course, really sadly for me, that my industry, comedy, like people say, like, you know, if I post something about like a female comedian that I like, to this day, I will get messages about me promoting that person that I have never got about me.
Yeah,
you know, nobody's ever written to me that they want to do those things or say those things. Even people who hate me have never written those things. But just because I said
so many
I like
great
this person,
women comedians coming up. I mean, that's one of the great things about the whole comedy scene for me now is, you know, all kinds of people: Sarah Pascoe and Sarah Kendall, and you know, lots of Australians, and there are just women.
Celia Pacola's new show with Luke McGregor is brilliant, Celia's brilliant, and there's so many. I mean, in the Australian scene, but the diverse.
I actually saw you at the Opera House supporting Sarah Silverman.
Oh, is that right? I love Sarah Silverman. Yeah. That was great fun times. That was a real thrill for me, because I actually was a great fan of hers beforehand. So that was very exciting. Okay, look, I do want to ask you a few more questions before we go. So this we're recording this a week out from the US election. Well, not even like it's going to. So
I'm not going to ask you to make a prediction or anything, but how do you feel about the state of the world in light of, you know, what's been happening in the UK, you know, what we see happening, you know, in America at the moment? Are you, you know, are you optimistic about where we are in the world? Do you feel like this is the way things always are to one degree or another, or are we in a time where everything's a bit...
Oh, I think it's really dangerous, and right. It's also really difficult for a journalist. I used to be able to predict elections. I didn't go out there on the radio and say this is going to happen, but privately, people who know me know that I used to generally have a really strong feel, and when there was a landslide coming, I knew there was a landslide. When it was going to be really tight, I knew it was going to be really tight. But just in the last few years, I can't do it anymore. I think there's something gone badly wrong with polling. That's one of the things that's happening. One of the things that feeds into that is just during I was on sick leave. I've been having some radiation therapy at this year's election, and so I was down in the country, and quite a few people were saying to me, "Oh, I just keep on getting these robocall questions from pollsters." And because it's a robot, I just lie to them. Right. I think it's hilarious that I can just lie to them. And I heard that anecdotally from a lot of people. So I think people are lying to pollsters to some degree. I think there is there's also a factor that people are lying to pollsters because they don't really, for instance, in the Brexit poll, I think a lot of people, because it was associated with anti-migration, a lot of people lied to human pollsters because they thought they would be seen as racist.
I mean, that's the interesting thing about the Trump numbers that nobody can quite put their finger on.
Yeah, that's what's
worrying. How many
worrying.
People in privacy might go in there who never would have said out loud and may not even tell their friends ever that they did it, but might go, you know, this is the choice. So America obviously is a big influential country on the state of the world, and it does feel like everything's moving around big Game of Thrones-y at the moment, you know.
Yep.
Putin's back, and obviously China, you know, are making some moves just establishing their power around the world in the way that they're doing it. And it does feel like a lot of things are moving into place. You've obviously spent a lot of time in the Middle East as well over the journey. How do you feel about like where things are placed? Is this... to me, it just feels like, it doesn't feel like, I remember the Cold War. I remember kind of the end of the Cold War, and I remember all that.
My book is really about the Cold War.
Well, I wasn't around enough to feel what happened before that.
Mm.
But it feels to me at the moment, having watched Game of Thrones, that it's like for six seasons, all these things have been moving into place. And now you have one empire, you know, America, the one who always considered themselves to be number one, but really... apart from nuclear weapons, there is no other measure by which you could consider them to be the number one country anymore. Oh, no, entertainment.
Well, their economy is still larger than any other.
And
China's catching up.
That's true. And a lot of it is owned by China now as well. But
there's a historian called Neil Ferguson who calls it Chimerica. They're locked in this sort of symbiotic embrace.
And that's... what it feels like, you know, they're all locked in together in these different sort of relationships, and it feels like instead of there having been one champion, now there's four or five different sort of, you know, blocks or areas that all have different strategies, but all... So where do you feel that, like, you know, in a world sense...
There's no dragons, that's the worst of it.
I mean, I'm sure there is dragons. I think that Kim Jong-un has been working on some dragons. They may not be actual dragons.
An underground dragon lair,
He may have, like, just stuck some paper mache to a horse, but everybody thinks it's a dragon.
Well, if he says it's a dragon, nobody's going to deny it.
Yeah, somebody's standing behind
it
with a lighter.
Nobody's going to contradict Kim Jong-un. You don't want to be fired out of a cannon.
Definitely saw a dragon. But with the rising fear over the climate changing and the fact that if what happens with the ocean levels rising, that it seems that the problems with, you know, asylum seekers are only going to get bigger because you're going to have climate people who are forced out of their homes by the changing climate. It just feels like the world, the planet at the moment with our population and the environment and these sort of, you know, geopolitical issues, then it just feels like, I don't know, how does it feel to you? Without, I've led the witness a lot now. How do you feel?
One of the awful things is that the biggest influence on population is prosperity. The more prosperous a country is, the less likely it is that the population will exceed, you know, right. 2.5. So if things get worse, the worse things get, the harder it's going to be to control population. On the other hand, the rate of population growth has been going down, so that is a good thing. And if it continues to go down at the rate it's going, then that will be a very good thing. China, I think, is not nearly as inevitable as people think it is, because they've got massive problems of soil, water, and air. They've got gigantic pollution problems, and they're really running out of land. That's why they build these enormous skyscraper cities, but which are also adding to the climate change, of course, because they involve vast amounts of concrete. But the Chinese, there is quite a strong theory which is yet to play out, that over the next decade, Chinese growth will hit its peak, because they've got this huge social problem, which is that one child policy has left all the boomers, the kids who survived the Cultural Revolution, actually, are going to be left with nobody looking after them. They don't have a social security system, a pensions system that is capable of looking after old people. And that's going to be a massive buffer up against which the Chinese economy runs. The Middle East, I think, is going to be incredibly dangerous and difficult for a decade, maybe two, three decades. It's a roiling mess that, you know, a vacuum which keeps, like, it's like a black hole that keeps on sucking more chaos into it. And I just don't see any way in which anyone can intervene in any significant way that'll make that better. Obviously Putin thinks he can, but, you know, I think he may be forgetting what happened to Russia and Afghanistan. We'll see that. And then with America, it's just everything depends on whether Donald Trump gets in. If Donald Trump gets in America, the thing that worries me most is in our region is that he has basically said, and this applies to Europe as well, he's basically said America's allies should look after themselves. He said they need to pay for themselves. They can't necessarily rely on America anymore. Now it's a founding principle of NATO that all the countries will go to each other's aid. So I'm really worried about Russia's ambitions to take back the Baltic states, Estonia, Lithuania, and Latvia. They will be the first to go. We've already seen what happened in Crimea. It's not as if it's a science fiction project. And in our region, the biggest danger is what he's saying about Japan and Korea, South Korea. Basically, if America says to them, look after yourselves, you know what they're going to do. They're going to nuke up.
Right.
They will be straight. And the Japanese have been forbidden, essentially, to have their own defense force, really, since the Second World War. They will have to engage in a massive building program to create a defense force, and they will get nukes. And if you're South Korea and you've got right just north of Pyongyang, you've got that demilitarized zone, and
right.
You know that there is massive artillery sitting on the other, just even without the nukes, there is enough artillery there to blitz half of Pyongyang. I said Pyongyang when I meant Seoul. If you're in South Korea and you're sitting there in Seoul,
right.
Just right above, just north of you, is the demilitarized zone, and there on the other side of it, there is enough standard conventional artillery, never mind the nuclear stuff, to just blast your city to half to smithereens on the first day of the war. So obviously you're going to start going for a nuclear weapon.
If America didn't come to our aid, how do you think that would change Australia? Because the truth of it is that we, because of our location and where we are, like, we have leaned particularly heavily on the idea that if ever Australia was, because there is no way we can defend this country. Doesn't matter how many new submarines they buy, Like, you know, they had eight. Putin bought four over for the G20 and we couldn't bring any around because I think three were in Western Australia and three were being repaired or something. You know, it's not... Like, we can't defend this country because it is so big and there is so much area. We can't defend it if we were to be attacked.
It's hellish difficult to attack, too, because it's so big. I mean, this goes back to the 70s, you know, when people in the Indonesian army used to joke about Australia. They used to call it South Timor.
Right.
But it is so huge, and I'm not suggesting that the armed resistance would be particularly... I think, you know, we have a pretty effective army. There would be armed resistance. And yes, it is very difficult to defend, and that's why we had the so-called Brisbane Lion in the Second World War, and all of there's all this military theory about it. I won't go into all of that, but I just think it's much more impractical to attack.
So, do you think that we wouldn't be left undefended down here? You think?
I just, without
the threat that America would come and look after us if we need it. Because, I mean, that's what we've had for the last, you know, 30, 40, 50 years, is the idea that, hey, you know what? And that's why we have these agreements with America where you let them have, you know, army bases and stuff here, is because based on this idea that if Australia is in trouble, it's the reason that we go to every war, they decide to start overseas.
No, I completely understand all that. But I think the thing is that if Trump gets in, there's just going to have to be this massive realignment right around this region. And if he says that stuff to the Japanese and the South Koreans, he might well say the same thing to us. But then South Korea, Indonesia, Japan, the Philippines, Thailand, Burma, etc., Cambodia, will have to start thinking really seriously about their own defences. And it will involve some kind of realignment, and Australia will have to be part of that. But I don't know, it's just impossible to forecast that stuff.
Look, I'm just hoping my plane lands next week. I'm flying over on election day, so hopefully they will have made their decision wisely by the time I land. Otherwise, they may not let the plane land. So LA may be on fire. Look, we should finish up, although I could talk to you all day and I have a million things that I would love to talk to you about. But I want to mention your book because, obviously, yeah, this is great timing. Your book has just come out. So tell people what it's called.
It's called Light and Shadow, Memoirs of a Spy's Son.
So... The headline is there and it's been all over the papers. And if people want to hear a brilliant interview over two parts, Richard Feidler's Conversations, which is a fantastic podcast based on information and chronological order and questions that make sense asked in a concise way rather than me just rambling for a while and then trying to... No. I mean, it's just a different podcast.
Yeah,
and
totally.
I think it's a brilliant podcast, Richard's podcast. So, and I would hope that perhaps you could listen to this in companion to that. Listen to Richard's, find out the story, read the book, and then, you know, maybe have heard a few things here that you might not find in either of those two things as well. You mentioned the idea that when you were sick, that you realized that you weren't for death, or how did you phrase it?
It's funny because I think, you know, I say that and somebody asked me that the other day, you know, do you ever think about dying or, you know, have you ever prepared yourself to die? And I never have. But then on a more general basis, I look at the last 22 years it is now since I had a very near-death experience, and I look back and I think what I've done is live every day at a time and ever since I've, you know, the last time, every time I come out of hospital, I think, you've had another reprieve. Just enjoy every day, take it as it comes. If I die tomorrow, I've thought about it enough. I'm certainly prepared for it, but I'm not looking for it. So I'm not in love with easeful death. I think there's a poem about that, isn't there?
And you said the idea that you're agnostic. So do you believe that when you die that you are dead? Is that what you believe to be true?
Yeah. I think you've got to pack it all in now. Pack all the life you can into this life. When I say I'm agnostic, I'm not. I'm just trying to distance myself from the really militant atheists. I don't begrudge anyone their religion, because it, I know how much of a source of comfort it can be for people. It's not for me, and also because I don't totally discount the idea that if not a god, there is some kind of super being that has set up a series of massive science experiments, one of it which happens to be our universe.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, you know, there are smarter people than both of us who have posited the idea of, you know, of other versions of that, whether they be explained by quantum physics
and
those sort of things. Those ideas sound as, you know, they sound as crazy. I use that word in the wrong way for what I'm going to say, but, you know,
religions, surreal as religion.
Surreal as religion. Yeah. And certainly, well, beyond our comprehension.
Yep.
In the same way as religion is. So I guess, well, with that in mind then, the question that I really want to ask you is, why do you think it's this? Like, if you don't know what it is, what's your sense that it's this? Why do you feel like you have been who you are? Why you have the desires that you have? Are you a subscriber to the idea that those things are evolutionary? Like the reason that we have become what we are is that it is the way that we have reproduced and evolved and those sort of things. Like it just feels very weird to me that if it means nothing, and by the way, when I say it means nothing, if we are... we live and we die and we're an accident in the corner of the universe, you know, blah, 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 that it came out like this. Why are you and I sitting here having this conversation now? What part of that could that possibly be?
Well, that's part of the Stoicism. The bit that I didn't mention about the Stoicism is that the Emperor Marcus Aurelius was a Stoic and Epictetus was a Stoic. And what comes out of their writings is this idea that the only thing... I'm a humanist Stoic. And the only thing that you can do with your life is to try and give as much to other people, at least as you take. And you can't expect to take anything, but if you act in a positive way, then not only will you leave some kind of possibly tiny positive mark on the world, but you will get positivity back, I suppose.
Well, that's a really nice way to finish. Look at that. You nailed it. At least we've got one professional broadcaster here. Mark, this has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for doing it and taking the time.
I've enjoyed it so much.
I genuinely appreciate it. And if people like the podcast, look, I am going to try to do it more regularly. I know I always say this. I do love doing it.
So many podcasts.
I have too many podcasts. I have an imaginary radio station. It's even, if you want to think there's a job where you get paid less than the ABC, yes, it's at my. You've seen my equipment, Mark. All right. Thank you so much. Oh, people, if they want to follow you on Twitter, where can they watch your... It's at Colvinus, is
that right? At Colvinius.
Vinius, that's right. At Colvinius on Twitter. Thank you very much, mate.